Chapter 11. You'll never believe what I've been doing. Dr. Prine, who was raised partly in a convent, had the idea that the peasants would like a mass, so Mrs. R., who I hope will not be long with us, but more on that later, dug up a soldier priest working with the Red Cross nearby. Our people here, the ones who live in our stables, swept the church and trimmed it with flowers, and I must say it did look pretty and not at all gaudy. The unit stood in the back and sang four French songs which Dr. Prine taught us, some of which were really quite patriotic and charming, although there was far too much about the nom de Sacré-Cœur for my liking. But the effect was very good, and all the peasants seemed to enjoy it. They kept thanking us again and again until it was really quite embarrassing. Afterward, we had 123 children here to play games on the lawn. I'd thought it would be the most frightful din, but they just trooped in and stood there, not making a mess or a noise. Really quite good little creatures and so happy for anything. Their mothers said they hadn't played for 3 years, so they'd forgotten how. I'm not sure we ought to teach them again. They're so well behaved this way. But the others insist it's not the least bit normal and they ought to be taught to run around and scream. If that's the way of American kindergartens, maybe we ought to send our children to school in France. Miss Maud Randolph, class of 1909, to her fiancé, Mr. Henry Craig. September 1917. Grécourt, France.
Have you seen the skipping ropes? I could have sworn I took out the skipping ropes.
Anne Dawlish took them. Kate dodged out of the way as Emmy staggered past, bearing an armload of hoops. The mass was over, and the unit was attempting to marshal an alarming number of children on the lawn behind the chateau. Alice Patton and Margaret Cooper presided behind a long trestle table, doling out coffee for the adults, very watery coffee, but coffee all the same, and milk from their own cows for the children. The cows, contrary to all of Kate's expectations, had arrived as promised and had responded well to the enthusiastic, if untutored, ministrations of the members of the Smith College Relief Unit. The cows weren't the only unexpected success. Kate looked around the lawn, at the members of the unit rushing about being useful, at the villagers overflowing what had once been the Baroness's private preserve, and had to admit that the mass had been, well, a smashing success. Kate had been privately convinced that it would be a disaster. She'd been worried that no one would come or that the unit would embarrass themselves. It would, thought Kate, be both the beginning and the end of their usefulness when the French villagers saw 17 American Protestants blundering their way through a mass, slaughtering the canticles and making inappropriate comments in carrying voices. But Julia had led them in procession across the fields, and Julia had sung the canticles in her high, clear voice, and somehow, with Julia in charge, it had all come out exactly right, and even Maud had behaved herself, clothed in an odor of self-conscious sanctity. The inhabitants of villages from miles away had streamed into the small church, filling it to capacity and overflowing into the churchyard. Kate had stood in the back of the church with the rest of the Smith unit as the priest in his scarlet vestments led the familiar Latin service, her lips moving to the long-known words, even as her gray uniform set her apart, set her with the other Smith women. Domine non sum dignus. Lord, I am not worthy. Alice had looked around nervously and copied whatever Julia was doing, usually several seconds behind. Liza had bounced on the balls of her feet and made the wrong responses in the wrong places, but with vigor. Emmy, of course, sang loudest of all, and almost entirely out of tune. The French were very patient about it and complimented them all lavishly, and Kate had left feeling somehow not cleansed, but with some unspoken fear unrealized. Even the weather had cooperated.
It was the most perfect sort of autumn day, the midday sun gilding the grass and the browning leaves, lighting the faces of the old Robecours on the walls of the chateau. The mayor had cleaned all their uniforms for them, and the gray, with its touches of French blue, looked wonderfully official as they all darted this way and that among the villagers, fetching milk, holding babies, explaining about the dispensary and the store. The unit was, Kate realized with a faint sense of disbelief, doing just exactly what it had set out to do. For all their differences, all their false starts, it was working. Over the past 10 days, they had made a start, a true start. The social workers had been diligently making their rounds, bringing with them milk from their own cows. The villagers had begun to straggle into the makeshift clinic the doctors held at Graycourt in the mornings. Their traveling store was to begin the next day, the Ford truck loaded with the results of Maud's buying trip to Paris. Maud had brought with her not just the chickens, but three of the missing members of their unit. Miss Baldwin, the librarian, who had arrived clutching an armload of French children's books she had begged, borrowed, or quite possibly stolen. Miss Mills, full of ideas about nursing picked up during her brief time at the Villier Hospital. Kate foresaw trouble there with Julia, who had pointed out that Miss Mills hadn't actually trained as a nurse. And Miss Ledbetter, the journalist, who came armed with a legion of anecdotes about the history of Graycourt, from the Merovingians to the present, almost undoubtedly apocryphal. They had all found themselves retiring very early from dinner the previous night under the onslaught of Miss Ledbetter's learned discourse. Fran poked Kate in the arm.
Quick, the Ledbetter is heading our way. Time to get more sweets for the children.
Do we have more sweets for the children? Maud had bought what she could in Paris, but anything made with sugar cost the earth, and whatever packages had been sent them from home were all held up by the Red Cross clearinghouse, distributed as it pleased them.
Does it matter? Asked Fran.
Fair point, said Kate. She'd been spending more and more time with Fran when not on her rounds, grateful for the other woman's easy company. Kate was, if she was being honest, avoiding Emmy, who kept trying to have discussions about their feelings. Kate didn't want to discuss her feelings. Much of the time, she was so tired she wasn't even sure she had feelings, and she was really quite happy with that.
Poor Alice. The Ledbetter's got her.
I'm sure she'll be fascinated to hear all about Clovis's triumph at whatever it was, said Fran. Next to the refreshment table, Maud was whispering something to Liza, one eye on Mrs. Rutherford.
Maud's looking quite cat and canary. Have you heard she traveled first class on a third class ticket?
Maud had only told them six times.
No, did she?
With mock seriousness, Fran said,
The real problem was that no one had thought to buy her a first-class ticket in the first place. This was only her way of putting the world back the way it ought to be.
Like those people who insist that if they'd been born centuries ago, they'd have been nobles and not peasants. In a pointy hat, agreed Fran, with a tame unicorn by her side. Don't mention it to Miss Ledbetter, though, or you'll hear more than you ever wanted about it, with excursions into the Song of Roland and the Almanach de Gotha.
Were those at the same time?
I have no idea. I was always more interested in physics than history. We aren't planning on letting Miss Ledbetter loose on those poor children, are we?
Not the littler ones. That's Emmy and Ann Dawlish and Nell Baldwin. Emmy will recite lyric poetry at them, but I think they should be able to weather it.
She was being catty about Emmy, and she shouldn't be. The truth was, she was still annoyed at Emmy, even though she knew she shouldn't be. And she was still punishing Emmy in small ways, even though she knew she shouldn't be. It made Kate feel petty and horrible, but she couldn't seem to stop herself.
Miss Ledbetter's supposed to be helping to teach the older children.
You taught older girls, didn't you?
Yes, French. I don't think that would be much use here.
Fran raised a brow.
Still?
I was a terrible teacher, Kate said firmly. It wasn't that she disliked children. She just had no talent for making them either love or mind her. Not like Emmy, who collected small children like the Pied Piper.
I hated every minute of it, and so did my unfortunate pupils. I refused to inflict myself on these poor children. Fran looked with concern at the group in front of them. They're so quiet. Children that age, they should be making such a din we could scarcely hear ourselves think. Miss Dawlish was working on getting a group of children to link hands and dance in a circle to Sur le Pont d'Avignon. She waved her arms about, bending exaggeratedly from the waist.
Les beaux garçons font comme ça.
The beaux garçons hung their heads and looked uncertainly at the ground. No one was running. No one was singing. No one was misbehaving. Emmy was running this way and that, with hoops and ropes, trying to coax children into activity, with distinctly limited success. I don't know much about children, but I do have four brothers. They used to tear through our house, screaming like banshees chasing each other. It had driven Kate mad at the time, the constant din, the way they would fling themselves at each other and at her, although they were rather sweet when they were snuggled up in her lap, for about 5 minutes. My brother and I were the same way. It gave my mother headaches. Fran thought for a moment. To be fair, everything gave my mother headaches, but Freddie and I really were that awful.
Do you think it's because they're undernourished? Asked Kate doubtfully, eyeing the subdued children.
They were certainly thin, there was no denying that, their skin an unhealthy gray, but it was more than that.
They haven't played for 3 years.
Dr. Stringfellow came and stood beside them, her eyebrows for once at rest.
They don't remember how. Some of them have no memory of life being other than this. It's sickening.
Is there anything we can do for them?
Not my department. I'll worm the ones who need worming, but there's no pill for having the childhood crushed out of you. If there were, I'd dispense it in bulk. And Bill Kaiser Wilhelm.
Kate and Fran looked at each other as Dr. Stringfellow stalked away.
I think she's experiencing human emotion, said Fran.
Does she have children? Asked Kate. Fran shook her head.
There is a husband. I saw a letter addressed to him, but I have no idea other than that. She's very private. I'm not sure I blame her.
Fran cast her a sympathetic look.
It's not easy to be private here, is it? All of us crammed into those little rooms, living in each other's pockets. Poor Alice keeps trying to find a place to have a private cry, but the best she can manage is under the covers when she thinks we're asleep. We shouldn't complain, I suppose, when you think of what we see in the villages.
A little ahead of them, having failed with hoops and skipping ropes, Emmy was trying to coax a group of the children into a game of catch.
Look, I'll show you, Emmy said encouragingly. You just take the ball and throw it to a friend, like this.
Emmy lobbed the ball, but the girl she'd chosen had turned away and didn't see the ball coming at her. It hit her in the shoulder. It wasn't a hard ball or a particularly hard throw, but the girl went rigid. For a moment, the world stood frozen, Emmy and the children staring, and then the girl dropped to the ground, her arms over her head, screaming. Screaming in a way Kate had never heard before. Horrible, high-pitched, inhuman screams.
I'm so sorry! I'm so sorry!
Emmy flung herself at the girl, trying to comfort her, but the girl just kept screaming and screaming, rolled into a ball in the dirt, kicking out when Emmy tried to touch her. Kate hadn't even realized she'd moved, but there she was, on her knees in the dirt next to the girl, elbowing Emmy aside. Because couldn't Emmy see she was making it worse, that the girl didn't want to be touched?
Don't! Leave her! Kate snapped.
The girl's screams were beginning to turn into something like sobs. Her wasted little body heaved and shook. Emmy's face was ashen. She sat back on her heels, staring at the child in horror.
I had no idea. I never meant. Oh, goodness.
Get her some milk. Kate said decisively, and Emmy stumbled to her feet, tripping over herself in her alarm. The child was still shaking, her head hidden in her arms, curled up like a hedgehog.
Hello, said Kate, not touching her, not moving.
We haven't been introduced yet. I'm Miss Moran. A bit of tear-stained face poked out.
Mademoiselle Moran?
The girl had turned Kate's name into the French word for chestnut. Well, yes, I can be Moran if you'd like. The girl lifted her head a bit more, sizing Kate up. She couldn't have been more than 5, 6 at most. She wiped her nose with the back of one hand. Her voice trembled.
Your hair is the color of your name.
Kate instinctively put her hand to her hair, which had been braided and twisted back. The braiding was an ineffectual attempt to keep out insect invaders. Chestnut? Yes, I suppose. I've only ever seen chestnuts after they were roasted. The girl didn't move.
We have lots of them in the woods.
Would you show me one of these days? I don't know anything about woods. I've only lived in towns. Slowly, the girl uncurled, sitting back on her heels.
Like Amiens?
A bit like Amiens.
But not as big,
said the girl, taking for granted that Amiens was the extent of the metropolitan experience. But much bigger. The girl's eyes widened. We have buildings taller than the highest church spire and railways that run on tracks in the sky.
You're making it up.
I'm not, I swear. Kate struggled up from her knees and held out a hand. Do you think you can get up now? The girl hesitated. There was dirt on her cheek where she'd buried her face in the ground. Kate resisted the urge to rub it away. The last thing the girl needed was fussing. Kate kept her hand extended, not moving. No one is going to throw anything at you again without warning, I promise.
I know it was just a ball,
the little girl said with dignity. All the same. Kate glanced around. Miss Dawlish had very determinedly got her group of children singing around about a windmill and a fish. Emmy was waiting in line for milk, looking deeply distressed, but none of the French women seemed to be headed their way. Where is your mother? The girl's face closed.
Avec les Boches.
Of course. She should have known better than to ask. Mine is in America, all the way across the ocean, in a city called Brooklyn. The girl looked interested, but Miss Baldwin came up, holding out a picture book. Won't you read with me? The girl went with her, with a backward glance for Kate. Kate gave her a little wave, and then joined the group at the refreshment table. Does anyone know who that girl was? She asked, breaking into a discussion about the best way to kill fleas. The one who was screaming. Emmy's face was gray.
I feel so awful. I never meant—
Alice Patton put down her coffee pot. That's one of mine, from the Basse-Cours. She's called Zélie. It's a terrible story. Well, they're all terrible stories, aren't they? Her whole family, mother, father, two older sisters, were all taken away by the Boche. Zélie and her brother were left with a neighbor. She's 5, he was 8. Was? Kate could feel her stomach doing something unpleasant. They were playing in a field, running about, as children do. That's what the people there told me, and he stumbled across an unexploded shell. She didn't need to say more. None of them did. Kate had to catch herself to keep from crossing herself. It wasn't something she'd done for years. She wasn't even sure where the impulse had come from.
Oh my goodness,
whispered Emmy, her eyes enormous in her stricken face, all bones and teeth.
Was he?
Alice fiddled with the handle of the coffee pot. She saw it happen. There wasn't enough left of him to bury.
So when I threw the ball,
Emmy clutched at her collar.
I have to make it up to her.
Stop. Kate grabbed her arm before she could go. Miss Baldwin's reading to her. Leave it be.
I can at least give her an extra candy.
And make her look like she needs special treatment? If you did that, it would be for your own sake, not hers. Emmy looked so stricken that Kate immediately felt guilty.
Emmy, I didn't mean... You're right.
Emmy ducked her head, blundering around the side of the refreshment table.
She's better this way. I'll just go help Margaret with the milk.
It is a great success, isn't it? Said Alice uncertainly. I mean, aside from poor Zaylee. Look how many people came to us.
And it will be even better when...
Liza began, but Maud elbowed her hard in the ribs. When we finally get some decent furniture in our barrack, said Maud decidedly. And curtains. It's unthinkable to have the sun shining in your eyes first thing in the morning. The general consensus was that the St. Matthew's Day celebration was a great triumph. When they met for breakfast the next morning, there was a festival air, everyone congratulating everyone else. Only Emmy seemed subdued. Kate had heard her thrashing about on her cot deep into the night.
Well done, ladies,
Mrs. Rutherford called them to order by tapping her coffee cup with her spoon.
Monsieur le Commandant was deeply impressed that we, foreigners, have a care not only for our people's bodies, but for their souls. He says it is a sign that we understand this place and will do right by it, and anything we need from him, we need only ask.
Medicine, said Dr. Stringfellow firmly. Ask for medicine.
And more books,
chimed in Miss Baldwin.
Did you know, said Miss Ledbetter, that the parish of Grey Corps was founded on St. Matthew's Day in the year of our Lord 1235? Just think of it. 20 years after Magna Carta, 200 years before Agincourt, this little scrap of land.
Everyone started talking at once, eager to avert further musings on the medieval. That nurse told me we should go to Miss Morgan's place at Blerincourt.
That nice French officer said he has another cow for us if we want it.
Could we add another village to our rounds?
Emmy's voice rose over the rest.
Someone was telling me about another village just a little farther north called Courcelles. It's in an awful way, they say. The Germans were stationed there during the early part of the war, but there was a terrible fire, and a German officer died, and they retaliated rather horribly. The priest was telling me there are 50 children there, and not one of them well. Couldn't we do something for them?
We've scarcely got the resources for the villages we already have, objected Kate, filled with a deep foreboding. We're practically out of medicine. We're going to have to go get some from the hospital in Amiens. And wouldn't we have to clear it with the French authorities?
It was the French authorities who brought it up to me, said Emmy,
looking around the table for support.
Well, that nurse who was there with the priest, she said there's far too much for them to do. They would be delighted for us to take it on.
I'm sure they would, said Fran dryly. Mrs. Rutherford tapped a finger thoughtfully against the side of her coffee cup. Kate was still having a hard time getting used to the cups. They were whimsical things, shaped like bowls with little wings to either side rather than a proper handle.
It's a sign of how word of our work is spreading. Monsieur le Commandant suggested we also add Bacquincourt and Epaville.
We can hardly take care of all of France,
Maud protested.
No, but we can manage this bit of it, said Mrs. Rutherford, calmly applying jam to her bread. In the little over a week that we've been here, Miss Van Alden alone has already made 51 calls on 42 families.
Emmy blushed, looking modestly down. Kate resisted the urge to point out that she had been there too.
Multiply that number by the rest of the members of our social work department. We've distributed milk, bread, honey, and baby clothing in 11 villages. Miss Dawlish is organizing a weekly children's meeting. The medical department has seen how many patients?
Nearly 300, said Dr. Stringfellow.
It would be more if the truck would stop breaking down.
Mrs. Rutherford made a note on her ever-present notepad.
Perhaps if we exchanged the tires on the white for hard rims. If we can do this much in 10 days, how much can we accomplish in 10 weeks or 10 months? I believe we can fit an extra village into our schedule. You can go this morning after breakfast, survey the village, see if we might do something useful there.
Emmy glowed like a saint in a medieval painting. Kate was feeling somewhat less sanguine. They already had more than 2,000 souls in their care, a large number of them children. As Dr. Stringfellow kept reminding them, they were nearly out of medicine. They didn't have enough lumber to build houses, even if they had people who knew how to build them, which they didn't. Most of their villages lacked pumps for the wells. The Germans had broken them, not to mention needing to dig new wells to replace the old ones, which had been poisoned.
And what if we decide it's too much for us? Won't we have raised expectations we can't meet?
Even if you only go today, that's something too. Bring what you can, do what you can. You'll still leave them better off than they were.
Any little bit is better than nothing?
Kate couldn't keep the skepticism out of her voice. We're only 17 women. I know we'll be 18 once Miss Luz finally gets here, but that's hardly any difference at all.
Our strength is as the strength of 10, murmured Mrs. Rutherford.
Kate decided not to get into a debate about pure hearts. Hers certainly wasn't.
We can count angels on the heads of pins all we like, or Smith girls on the backs of trucks, but we have all of 3 motors, 3 teachers, and 2 doctors. How can we sustain services for that many people in that many villages?
We don't, Mrs. Rutherford said, and smiled at her. That's the whole point of it. They have their own teachers, not as many as before, but some. Once we build their schoolhouses back up, once we give them the books they need, we'll leave them to it. Bit by bit, they'll need us less and less. We provide the foundation, and they'll do the rest.
That's a lot of foundation, said Kate.
An airplane droned overhead, a reminder that their time here might be limited. Mrs. Rutherford patted her hand.
Day by day, Miss Moran. Day by day. Ah, there's the post.
Through the window, they could see a man cycling along one of the few surviving paths.
Shall we go meet him?
There was a mad rush for the door of the barrack. Kate held back, trailing along at the end of the group. There wouldn't, she knew, be anything for her. She'd written her mother with their forwarding address, but her mother was busy, she knew. Busy with the boys, busy with the house, busy with the large circle of family and friends she had acquired through her second marriage. Kate had written, at first, that first year at Smith, but it had rapidly become clear that her letters only made things worse, that those things she had viewed as triumphs, being elected to a literary society, being chosen for a role in a play, seemed painfully trivial to her mother. Worse than trivial, frivolous. And on her side, Kate had tried not to be hurt that her mother's letters seemed to be exclusively devoted to praising her brothers. She had tried to go home again, briefly, after Newport, but her family hadn't known what to do with her. They had their patterns, which didn't include her. She didn't belong to Emmy's world, but she couldn't go back to her own either. She was lost, stranded, neither here nor there.
3 for you, Maud. Lucky you, said Liza,
delving happily into the mailbag like a puppy digging for treats.
And I've got one from Harry, too. Isn't he a darling to think of me? There's a thick stack for you, Mrs. Rutherford, and a telegram for you from the committee. You've got a telegram, too, Fran.
Is there anything for me? Emmy asked hopefully.
One from Andover, said Liza, squinting at the stamps. Oh, that will be my brother. There's nothing from anyone else?
No, just the one, said Liza cheerfully. But you know how these things are. Nothing for weeks and weeks, and then you get 15 all at once.
Yes, that must be what it is, said Alice Patton, turning away from the pile, which contained nothing for her.
Time to work, ladies.
Mrs. Rutherford crumpled the telegram and let it drop to the table.
We cannot rest on our laurels. This is a war zone. Time is of the essence. Miss Moran, Miss Van Alden, Courcelle. Miss Patton, Miss Mills, Dr. Prine, the dispensary, then take the jitney for visits. Miss England, Miss Cooper, the wheel has come off the white again. Miss Baldwin, Miss Dawlish, Miss Ledbetter, sewing and carpentry classes for the children of the nearer villages.
What about us? Maud asked. She was looking at Mrs. Rutherford and the crumpled telegram in a way Kate didn't quite like. Cat and canary, Fran had called it yesterday, and she wasn't wrong.
If Maud had had whiskers, she would be licking them. Mrs. Rutherford looked at Maud, her face seeming suddenly older.
Miss Randolph and Miss Shaw, load the Ford truck for the traveling store. Ava, if you could come with me for a moment.
Certainly, said Dr. Stringfellow, casting a quick, concerned glance at her old roommate.
Onward,
said Mrs. Rutherford brightly, clapping her hands together, and whisked out of the room with more speed than grace.
Dr. Stringfellow followed Mrs. Rutherford through the connecting door from the dining room into their office, which was also their bedroom, and shut the door firmly behind her, leaving the rest of the unit in the dining room staring after them.
I wonder what that was all about,
murmured Kate to Fran, but Fran didn't answer. She was holding her telegram, her face frozen in an expression of disbelief.
Fran, are you all right?
Fran lifted her head, her eyes glazed.
It's my mother. She's dead.
Chapter 12. I don't dare say much about the war. Somehow, the actual horror never got hold of me while I was at home, but here there is no escaping it. I can no longer think in terms of flags and parades and patriotism and glory. I just see mutilated bodies, destroyed homes, and wretchedness.
Miss Alice Patton, class of 1910, to her sister, Mrs. Gilbert Thomas. September 1917. Grecourt, France.
Dead? Repeated Alice, horrified.
Fran turned the telegram around so they could all see the stark block capitals. Mother dead, Tuesday, stop, return home soonest, stop, Aunt M.
That's blunt, said Kate.
Fran gave a choked laugh. It was a horrible sound. Auntie Mill won't have wanted to spend the extra money to say passed away.
Marie stuck her head around the doorframe. There are children in the Angerie, she said, much as she might have said mice. Many children.
Oh dear, said Anne Dawlish. That's my carpentry class. Fran
gave a terse nod.
The children are waiting. Go.
Miss Baldwin followed, giving Fran's hand a quick squeeze along the way. Miss Ledbetter paused in the doorway.
When the old lords passed away, their bodies would lie in state in the castle chapel, all their loyal retainers passing by to pay homage.
Kate looked at her incredulously.
The children are waiting, Miss Ledbetter.
Anne Dawlish grabbed the older woman by the arm and tugged her away before she could start singing entirely apocryphal medieval funeral songs.
I think that's her way of showing sympathy,
murmured Emmy.
We have a cook and a scullery maid, said Fran unsteadily. I don't think they'll be kneeling by my mother's corpse with candles.
Corpse. Mother. I can't believe. She's been poorly for so long. We thought her illness was a sort of hobby.
Kate and Emmy exchanged alarmed looks.
Here.
Emmy grabbed up Fran's coffee cup from the table.
Oh, dear, I wish we had some sugar. Sugar is meant to be good for shock.
Sherry, said Alice, turning with sudden decision for the door of the barrack.
What you need is sherry. I have some in my trunk, for medicinal purposes. If this isn't a medicinal purpose, I don't know what is.
No, no.
Fran waved her arms futilely at them both.
The last thing I need is spirits at 8 in the morning, or your whole sugar ration. And aren't you supposed to be at the dispensary?
Alice bit her lip, looking back over her shoulder as though unsure what to do.
Miss Mills and Dr. Prine have already gone. They won't miss me for a bit. They'll probably be glad I'm not there. I'm always dropping the bandages.
What can we do?
Kate asked quietly. Fran put her hands to her temples.
A train. I'll need to take the train to Paris. My aunt will need bucking up. They've kept house together since my father died. and there'll be practical matters to be dealt with. How long do you think it will take to get passage out?
I think you need to wait 6 weeks before they let you go, said Margaret Cooper.
Emmy had forgotten she was there. She had been standing so quietly.
Someone mentioned it to me in Paris. I think it's so they can make sure you're not taking home unauthorized information from the war zone.
6 weeks? But the funeral... Oh, heavens, what am I saying? I'll miss the funeral either way. And Freddie is over here too. Poor mother. We never imagined.
Maybe they'll let you go sooner since it's a bereavement, suggested Liza.
Fran shook her head.
I doubt it. And if so, they shouldn't. I could be faking it for all they know. No, I'll wait my time. Maybe they'll let me see Freddie.
She turned her head so they couldn't see her lip wobble, saying in a falsely energetic voice,
He's younger. He'll need me.
Well, I think you should go at once, said Maud, even though no one had asked her.
Come along, Liza. We're meant to be stacking boxes.
Do you think we ought to send flowers?
Emmy heard Liza whisper as she followed Maud out the door.
Where would we send flowers? To the second barrack from the left?
I just thought that we ought to do something.
The door thumped shut, cutting off their voices. Fran buried her head in her hands, choking on a laugh.
I can't say I'll miss them, but I'll miss you. I'll miss all of you. I'll even miss that hideous Ford truck.
Only on a downgrade. Kate reached out, not quite touching her.
I'm so sorry, Fran.
It comes to us all, I suppose.
Fran managed a crooked smile.
I'm sure my mother is feeling terribly vindicated.
I can go up to Paris with you until you sail,
offered Alice with sudden resolve.
I've got to run Dr. Prine and Miss Mills on their rounds, but then I'll come back and go with you. We can catch an afternoon train from Noyon.
We'll be down 2 chauffeurs that way.
Fran winced.
I mean, you'll be down 2 chauffeurs. Won't Mrs. Rutherford object?
Alice hunched her shoulders.
You shouldn't have to be alone in Paris while you wait out your 6 weeks.
Thank you. I won't say no to that.
Fran blinked rapidly.
I need to tell Mrs. Rutherford, and I'll need to pack.
I'll help you pack,
Emmy said quickly, feeling like she ought to do something.
You don't need to worry about a thing. Just let the rest of us take care of you.
I'm not an invalid, Fran protested. Mother was the invalid.
You're the least invalidish person I know, said Kate bracingly. To Emmy, she said,
We're meant to be going to Courcelles, remember?
I suppose we could go to Courcelles another day?
Emmy hated the idea of giving up Courcelles, but they couldn't possibly leave Fran by herself. Not after news like that.
No, said Fran quickly. No, don't put it off. The work is the important thing. I've held you up enough already.
I can go to Courcelles, offered Margaret tentatively. I was supposed to be driving Dr. Stringfellow, but she's busy with Mrs. Rutherford.
That's all right then, isn't it?
Said Alice, as it belatedly occurred to Emmy that if Margaret could go to Courcelles, she could equally well have stayed with Fran, and that both Emmy and Margaret would probably have preferred that. But it was too late now. Kate was giving Fran a quick, hard hug and telling her how much she'd be missed, and Margaret was buttoning up her uniform jacket and grabbing her hat, and Alice flitted off to the dispensary, and Emmy was left pressing coffee on Fran, who didn't seem to want either coffee or sympathy, but only to be left alone. Fran didn't need Emmy's help with packing. Alice's belongings were scattered all over the room, a small mirror hanging crookedly over a makeshift dressing table, hats in a drift on the floor, a shawl trailing over the end of a cot. But Fran's belongings were all neatly folded in her trunk in lieu of a wardrobe. It was the work of only a few moments to add her nightclothes and hairbrush.
I'll leave my blankets, said Fran, looking around the room as though trying to memorize it. I'm sure you can find a use for them.
Are you sure you won't want them in Paris?
Asked Emmy, and then realized how silly that sounded.
You'll be going back to the Quai Voltaire until you sail?
At least you'll be able to get one of the rooms with a bed this time.
Yes, said Fran bleakly. Small blessings. Emmy tried to make it better by bustling around, plumping pillows and rustling blankets.
Would you like to lie down? Can I get you a cold compress?
I've been bereaved. I haven't bumped my head. It's all right. You don't need to hold my hand. I have some letters I should be writing.
Are you sure? I could...
The look on Fran's face stopped her. It was a look of such uncomprehending misery that Emmy wanted to run to her and hug her, but that was clearly the last thing Fran wanted, so Emmy backed toward the door, saying,
I'll just go help Maud and Liza with the boxes, shall I? I'll be in the cellar if you need me, for anything, anything at all.
Thank you, said Fran distantly. Through the bare windows, Emmy could see Fran sitting on her bed, not writing, not reading, not doing anything, just sitting. She looked the way Emmy's schoolchildren did when they fell in the play yard, when they realized they'd been hurt but hadn't quite started howling yet. That moment of stunned disbelief before the pain set in.
Mademoiselle!
Emmy gave a guilty start as Marie bore down on her, launching into a detailed scold. The other girls, they had been asking about their laundry. Did they not know that the laundry was available only on Sunday? Marie couldn't be expected to do all things. And why hadn't they finished the pot-au-feu she had made for them last night? Did they not appreciate her cooking? Did they know what it was to cook on a range beneath a canvas roof with such ingredients as she was given?
I'm so sorry, said Emmy when she could get a word in edgewise.
Marie had already threatened to quit twice in the 10 days since they had arrived. The answer was usually to apologize and offer her more money, but Emmy was feeling too wretched to go through the regular routine.
Miss England, her mother just died. Everyone's terribly upset.
Marie was instantly in charge of the situation. A consommé, that was what was needed. She would wring the neck of a chicken at once.
Oh, please don't, said Emmy,
and immediately realized her mistake.
I'm sure it would be delicious. It's just that we need the eggs for the children, if they ever do start laying eggs. I do hope they start laying eggs soon, but perhaps some coffee? You do make the best coffee.
Maybe Fran might even want the coffee. Emmy wasn't sure what else to do for her. It was only 10 o'clock. It felt terribly strange to be left at Graycourt while the others were out. They had been here 10 days now, and except for the mass, Emmy had spent every day visiting, making the rounds of villages with Kate, calling on each local mayor, looking in on families. Most days, they didn't even make it back for lunch, dining on bread and cheese as the white truck bounced between ruts. She really should have just gone with Kate. Fran didn't want her. But it was too late now, so she would just have to make the best of it and try to find something useful to do in between checking in on Fran. Emmy hurried down to the cellar, where Maud and Liza were bumping boxes around, sorting out goods to put on the truck for the inaugural journey of their traveling store.
Today?
Liza was asking, her voice muffled by a large pile of linens. I don't know. It depends what they... Oh, Emmeline! We didn't see you there. Maud made it sound like an accusation. Emmy looked around the newly whitewashed room. The poilu had done a thorough job. She couldn't see where the chicken wire or the rude German inscriptions had once been.
Fran is writing letters, so I thought I'd come and see if I could help you down here.
Yes, it's too terrible about her mother, but at least she gets to go back to Paris. You don't mind playing porter, do you? We're just about ready to haul everything up to the truck. Emmy carried armloads of pots and kettles up the stairs to the truck, juggling rakes and scrubbing brushes, papers bristling with pins, spools of thread in serviceable blacks and browns, boxes of nails, shovels and trowels in all lengths and sizes, and even a consignment of axes, which Emmy held very, very carefully as she navigated the uneven treads.
I never thought I'd turn peddler, said Maud. Lord, what they'd say at home if they could see us now.
The truck backfired and finally started. Emmy waved farewell to them, watching as Liza narrowly avoided smashing one of the gates on her way out. She could hear Maud's protest all the way over the moat. Overhead, a plane wheezed by, and then another, circling each other, emitting puffs of smoke. Those little cotton-colored clouds looked so innocent until one remembered they were ammunition, meant to bring a plane down and end a man's life. Another plane joined in, way up in the clouds, puffing away like anything. 40 puffs like candy floss and the high, whining sound of the motors overhead. Dr. Stringfellow stuck her head out of the room where she was in conference with Dr. Rutherford.
"Where's Kate?"
"She went to Corcell," said Emmy,
surprised that Dr. Stringfellow had forgotten.
"Is something wrong?"
The doctor didn't bother to answer.
"When she gets back, send her in to us."
Dr. Stringfellow's head disappeared again before Emmy could ask why they wanted Kate. She hoped Kate wasn't in trouble. She wasn't sure why Kate would be in trouble, unless it was something to do with... But no, as long as the money was being paid, it shouldn't matter where it was coming from. They were laying the table for dinner, Emmy trying to remember not to set places for Fran and Alice, the table looking so much emptier with their chairs removed from it, when the white finally lurched over the moat. Emmy left Ann Dawlish and Miss Baldwin laying out plates and ran out to greet them.
"Oh, thank goodness you're back. Did you have a puncture? You've missed Alice and Fran. They left an hour ago."
"It's Margaret," Kate said without preamble, sliding down out of the white into a patch of mud. "She's not well." Emmy hurried to the other side of the truck, where Margaret sat curled up on the bench, her elbows on her knees, her face in her hands, her thin back shaking. Emmy looked back at Kate with concern.
"Oh, goodness, what happened? Is she ill? I can get the doctors."
Kate lowered her voice, forcing Emmy to bend to hear her. "She's been like this since Corcell. She had a fit of hysterics and then threw up by the side of the road, and she hasn't spoken since."
"That pot au feu did taste a little off last night. Poor thing. I think I have some bicarbonate left. It's not the food."
"I think she's having what the French would call a crise de nerfs."
"An anxiety attack?"
It sounded so much better, so much more elegant in French, but the result was the same in either language.
"What happened?"
"Corcell," said Kate simply.
"Miss Moran,"
Dr. Stringfellow beckoned brusquely.
"You're needed."
"They've been wanting to speak to you. I don't know what about,"
said Emmy.
"You go. I'll manage. Margaret, your poor cold hands. Let's get you inside and warmed up."
It was hard getting Margaret out of the truck. She did little to help herself. Well, she couldn't, poor thing. She couldn't seem to stop shaking, and it took Emmy wrapping an arm around her waist and guiding her step by step to get her back to the barrack, tripping over things and slipping in the damp grass as they bumbled along together like the participants in a three-legged race. If one of the participants was shaking with fever, that was.
"It's all so useless."
Margaret leaned heavily against Emmy as Emmy tried to maneuver her through the door of the barrack without tripping on her own skirt.
"What are we really doing here? We'll never really be able to do anything." "Just one more step now. Almost there."
Margaret's arm around her neck was nearly choking her.
"Let me feel your head. I don't think you're running a fever. You do seem awfully cold, though. Let's get you wrapped up in some blankets. Fran left hers."
"Lucky Fran," said Margaret violently,
and Emmy stared at her in shock. Margaret made a quick, apologetic gesture.
"I didn't mean that. Only I did. It's just, what are we doing here? Why don't you sit down?"
Emmy guided Margaret to her cot.
"Think how wonderful it was yesterday, all of us together and all the villagers so happy."
"Happy?"
Margaret stared up at Emmy, her pupils dilated.
"I can hear that girl screaming."
Emmy bit her lip.
"I made a mistake. But the other children, they weren't like children at all. They were like ghosts. They're all ghosts here. We're living with ghosts.
No, not ghosts. Monsters. It's hideous. It's all hideous. Why are we here? We didn't have to be here.
She was shaking so hard, Emmy could hear her teeth chattering.
Coffee, said Emmy. What you need is some hot coffee.
No, I couldn't. I'll be ill.
No coffee, then,
said Emmy soothingly, wondering if she ought to try Alice's sherry or if that would only make Margaret feel worse. Margaret was talking again in a small, hoarse voice.
I thought if I could be busy and useful, then it might not be so awful. But it just gets worse and worse and worse. It was all Beth's idea, but then Beth didn't come. I never wanted to be here. I shouldn't be here. I'm not making anything better by being here. I'm just driving around in circles recording horrors.
Remember the singing? Asked Emmy desperately. Remember the canticles? Ils ne l'auront jamais, jamais se paye de pour notre France. Wasn't it tremendous? It made everyone feel so much better.
Did it?
Margaret made a choking sound.
We can't sing everything better. I thought we could. I thought we could do what Mrs. Rutherford said. We could bring them hope. It all sounded so easy. But the boy I saw today, he wasn't human anymore. Do you know what they'd done to him? They took an explosive and made him hold it. And then they set it off. He lost his arm and half his face, but he didn't die. That's the worst of it.
Margaret's voice rose to a painful pitch on the edge of hysteria.
He didn't die!
Emmy's stomach twisted.
This was in Courcelles.
It was Emmy who had insisted they go to Courcelles. She should have been in Courcelles, not Margaret.
I know it's a war. You don't need to tell me it's a war. But these aren't soldiers. These are just normal people. And there was no point to what they did to that poor boy. It wasn't a battle. It was just cruel. They maimed him for the fun of it.
Maybe it was an accident. Maybe they didn't mean for it to happen.
They did, said Margaret sharply. That was what the villagers said. You didn't see it. You didn't see him. It was inhumane, Emmy. It was evil. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here anymore. I'm not cut out for it.
Emmy sank down on the bed next to her, feeling the cot sag under her weight.
You don't need to go back to Courcelles. You should never have been there. It was my idea. I'm sorry.
Margaret leaned into Emmy, burying her head in Emmy's chest.
If it were only Courcelles. It's all of this. Everything since we arrived, all the widows and the wounded and the air raids and the constant banging of the guns. I can't sleep at night without seeing those faces. Faces without noses, without chins, without ears.
You mean the ones in the hospital? But they're making them better. They're working wonders.
Nightmares. They're making walking nightmares. And those are soldiers. This boy, oh, Emmy.
Shh, said Emmy, cradling her as though she were one of Emmy's little brothers having a nightmare. Margaret pulled away from her, staring up at her with haunted eyes.
He was only 4 when they did this to him, Emmy. 4. I'll never be able to unsee that. I'll remember it when I sleep. I'll remember it when I die. Oh, Lord, I'm going to be ill again.
Let me get you some water.
Emmy lurched to her feet. Her hands were shaking as she poured water into a tumbler, slopping it over the sides. Only 4. She remembered holding her brother Bobby at 4. Bobby had always had nightmares, and Nurse wasn't the coddling sort, so Emmy had gone. She could remember the feel of that little body, the smell of his head, the trust. Only 4. Making a decision, Emmy reached into the bag she took with her on her rounds with its meager supply of Ambrine, headache powders, and sleeping draughts. She took out a twist of white paper, emptying the powder into the glass.
I thought I could bear it,
Margaret said plaintively.
I really did.
I know it's hard, said Emmy.
She held out the glass to Margaret, feeling like Lady Macbeth. But Macbeth murdered sleep, and Emmy was trying to bring sleep, so it really wasn't at all the same. At least, she hoped not. Water darkened the blanket as Margaret tried to take the cup.
If Beth had been here, at least you and Kate have each other. It makes it easier to have someone. You need someone here.
Emmy sat down next to Margaret, helping to guide the cup to her lips.
You'll feel better after a sleep. But I can't sleep. If I dream, I'll sit by you,
promised Emmy, aware that it was so little, so painfully little. Corcel had been her task, her responsibility. She'd wanted to feel like she was doing something for Fran. It had been irredeemably selfish.
I'll sit by you. And if you feel a nightmare coming on, I'll be here with you. I wish I were brave, like you.
You are brave, Emmy said, stroking Margaret's hair.
You're brave to have come here at all. You'll realize that once you've had a good sleep. Can't sleep.
Margaret's shivers were subsiding, her body relaxing into sleep. Emmy hoped she hadn't misjudged the dose. She hadn't realized how thin Margaret had become, much thinner than when they'd set sail on the Rochambeau. She hadn't realized a lot of things. Gently, Emmy tucked an extra blanket over Margaret, one of Fran's blankets.
She's sleeping,
Emmy whispered as Kate came through the door. Not that she needed to whisper. With that much sedative, nothing short of a German invasion should wake Margaret now.
Are they waiting dinner for me? I don't want to leave Margaret. I promised I'd stay by her.
No, they've all eaten. Kate's voice sounded funny. Emmy couldn't see her face properly. Darkness had fallen, and Emmy hadn't thought to light the lamp. Emmy rose very carefully, trying not to jostle Margaret.
What is it? What's happened? Why did they want to see you?
Mrs. Rutherford is resigning as director. Emmy caught her shin on the edge of her trunk, barely noticing the pain.
But that's impossible. Mrs. Rutherford is the unit.
Not according to the committee. Kate kept her voice low, glancing back over her shoulder. The walls of the barrack weren't particularly thick.
Mrs. Rutherford is being forced to step down effective immediately. They're going to put it about that she's resigning for health reasons. I don't understand.
Emmy realized she had her hand to her mouth like the heroine in a melodrama. She forced herself to lower it.
I know Maud was trying, but why would the committee?
Kate shook her head wearily. Apparently, there were some issues in the past. The committee wasn't sure Mrs. Rutherford was entirely stable. I don't know all of it. Dr. Stringfellow wasn't exactly forthcoming. She's the new director now.
Oh.
Dr. Stringfellow was certainly competent, frighteningly competent, but Mrs. Rutherford had a magic about her, a way of making things happen when you thought they could never happen at all. Passes, army camions. The unit without Mrs. Rutherford was unthinkable. Emmy was suddenly, desperately afraid.
Is Mrs. Rutherford staying on at all?
She wanted to, but Dr. Stringfellow thought it would be too divisive. So she's going to go to Paris for a month in case we need her, and then back to the States to raise money for the unit.
But we do need her. We need her desperately.
Emmy's mind was roiling. She could write her mother. Her mother's name had authority. There was no denying it. Although whether her mother would decide to help or not was entirely uncertain. Don't you think we can manage without her? Kate's voice had a funny note to it.
I don't want to manage without her.
She sounded like a child. Emmy made a conscious effort to gather her wits about her.
Why were they asking for you? Are they telling us all one by one?
No. Kate sat down, very slowly, on her cot. Mrs. Rutherford had certain conditions before she would agree to go.
Conditions?
Margaret was snoring now, little snorts and hums. She wants me to take Dr. Stringfellow's place as assistant director. But Kate hadn't even wanted to come. She had no background in social work. This hadn't been her project to begin with. Emmy looked over at Kate, looking so small, so braced for battle, and abandoned everything she had been about to say.
Congratulations. I'm sure you'll do a brilliant job.
Mrs. Rutherford didn't ask me for my brilliance. She asked me because she thinks I can keep the accounts and keep the machinery she's set up running. She doesn't want the unit broken up and sold for scrap to the Red Cross.
Is that what she said?
Emmy wasn't sure whether to be relieved or offended on Kate's behalf.
In that many words, Dr. Stringfellow is too busy with the medical end of things to manage everything that needs to be managed, so they need someone practical to run the day-to-day. That's all. I think she wants me because I don't have a vision of my own. Do you think we'll be able to go on without her?
Kate rose, pressing the wrinkles out of her skirt with her hands. I'll have to see that we do.
We'll have to see that we do.
Impulsively, Emmy reached out and took her hand.
We're all in this together.
Except for Fran, who had left, and Alice, who had gone with her, and Margaret. Emmy glanced down at her blanket-wrapped form. Hopefully Margaret would feel better in the morning, as long as the sleeping powder didn't give her a terrible headache. Emmy decided not to mention any of that.
I'm sure you'll be a wonderful assistant director.
And she was, mostly. Thank you. Kate let go of Emmy's hand. We'll see how long I last. I'm sure Maud will waste no time writing the committee about me.